Thank you very much. Good afternoon to everyone. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me to address this audience. I have to say it's very uplifting to see so many young people in this audience. When we do conferences at INSS, it's very difficult to get such a young audience, so kol hakavod. I'm going to be addressing how Israel has related to the Iranian nuclear program and to the international efforts to stop Iran in the nuclear realm. From the 1990s, and based on intelligence gathering, Israel concluded that Iran was harboring military ambitions in the nuclear realm and indeed was advancing a secret military nuclear program in parallel to its civilian one. Israel made great efforts to convince the international community that this was the case, but it was not an easy task. Indeed, it took until 1997 before even the Americans accepted that something problematic was going on with Iran's nuclear program. But I would say that Israel's diplomatic efforts only began to bear more serious international fruit, if you will, in 2002 when incriminating evidence regarding Iran's nuclear program did come to light. And as I'm sure you're all aware, in the summer of 2002, information was revealed that Iran was constructing two secret nuclear facilities, a uranium enrichment plant in Natanz, and a heavy water reactor in Iraq. And these two facilities, the construction of these facilities, had not been reported to the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agencies. And these revelations were, in a sense, a validation of Israel's concerns with regard to Iran, and the issue was finally brought in a serious manner to international attention. The head of the IAEA at the time, Mohammad El-Baradei, went to Iran to inspect the sites. He came to the conclusion that the information was accurate and Iran was in violation of its safeguard agreements with the IAEA. This is in accordance with its NPT membership, NPT, of course, being the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. In October 2003, the IAEA was poised to refer Iran's case to the UN Security Council for sanctions because of this violation, but in a critical 10-day period towards the end of October, the EU three states, Germany, France, and Britain, stepped up to the plate, said, we know how to talk to the Iranians, we will negotiate, we will get the Iranians to back away from these problematic activities. As far as Israel was concerned, at that time, in 2003, Prime Minister of Israel was Ariel Sharon. He served from 2001 to March of 2006. He, of course, had his stroke in January of 2006. And Sharon's clear preference was that Israel not position itself at the forefront of the Iran nuclear crisis. So it was Israel that had brought the information to the attention of the international actors, but the idea during Sharon's premiership was that Israel should not be at the forefront. The EU three were engaged in negotiations with Iran, and Israel's strategy at that point was to let them lead the diplomatic path that they had chosen. Moreover, Sharon trusted President Bush, U.S. President Bush, and he believed fundamentally that the Americans would do what needed to be done if push came to shove. At that time, there was still significant pressure on Iran. If we think back to late 2003, obviously the effect of the war in Iraq was still very strong. Iran was fearful that it might be next in line for attack, and therefore the sense that the Americans were there in the background in a strong manner was high in Sharon's mind. Finally, although Sharon was very concerned with the Iranian nuclear issue, not to make a mistake with regard to his concern, there was not an acute sense of urgency in those years. Iran was still in the very early stages of its fissile material production activities, and the sense was that there was still time. But Israel continued its conversations with the Americans and with the Europeans behind the scenes. Even as the Europeans took the reins in the negotiation, there were still European states that were not convinced that Iran was conducting a parallel military nuclear program. And Israel was striving to convince them that there indeed was a military component to Iran's nuclear program and activities. And in parallel, Israel was engaged in its own efforts to slow down Iran's nuclear progress. The most well-known element of this campaign, of course, that was revealed a little later, is the Stuxnet computer virus that upset the operation of Iran's centrifuges, put about 1,000 centrifuges out of order. But Israel is also accused of being behind some explosions at military and nuclear facilities in Iran, as well as some of the targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists. After not a long time, that strategy ended. You should know that Israel has a long history of having a long arm that can reach deep into the Arab world, that can reach terrorists that hide in different places in the Arab world. This is part of Israel's image of strategic superiority in the Middle East. Moving to Ehud Olmert's tenure, this was from April of 2006 until March of 2009. Israel's strategy remained basically the same. First, stay out of the limelight. Don't make this about Israel because it's an international security concern, and leave it to the Americans. By this time, the EU3 talks had reached an impasse. Ahmadinejad was president of Iran, and Bush was still in the White House. And during these years, Israel was also engaged in preparing its own military option. The noticeable change in Israel's approach came, not surprisingly, I'm sure you're all well aware of this, in 2009 when Netanyahu again became prime minister. Netanyahu quickly brought Israel to the forefront of the Iran nuclear debate. And this shift in approach, I think, was a reflection of a number of factors. First of all, there were factors that were related to Netanyahu as Netanyahu. He had a personal investment in the Iranian nuclear issue, and this went back to the first time that he was prime minister in the 1990s. He had a sense, and many people that talk about this issue give expression to this, people that worked with Netanyahu, that were very close to Netanyahu, that he had a sense that this was, you know, his personal issue, that he had some historic role to play in saving Israel from its mortal enemy. But to be fair, there were also objective factors that were fueling an increased sense of urgency in 2009, namely the continued advancement of Iran's nuclear activities and its nuclear program, and the parallel failure of the negotiations, the EU3 negotiations, and the attempts to negotiate in different formats up until 2009. So those 6 years did not produce the hoped-for fruits through negotiations. And by the time 2009 rolled around, Iran was much closer to its goal. There was no serious pressure on Iran, the essential component of leverage that you need in a negotiation with Iran in order to compel Iran to comply with international demands. The sanctions through the UN Security Council were not very strong, and they were not hurting Iran. And the reason was that every round of sanctions was watered down to the lowest common denominator. Usually, that denominator was set by Russia and China. And the other source of possible pressure, the threat of U.S. military force if Iran didn't cooperate, and I urge you to make a distinction in the realm of military force between a credible threat of military force, which is a source of pressure, we call that deterrent, and actual preparations to use military force. And those are two different options that states have to pressure other states. So the fact that you are threatening possible military force if Iran doesn't cooperate is a different tool of statecraft than actually thinking about using military force, although there is obviously a connection between the two strategies. But the threat of U.S. military force had also receded, even though President Obama continued to promise that all options were on the table. In 2011, Israel's policy on the Iranian nuclear issue contained the following elements. 2011, creating Israel's own military option, helping the U.S. any way it could on the sanctions front. Some of the ideas of sanctions were Israeli ideas. Working with Congress with regard to sanctions. Helping the U.S. vis-a-vis the other P5 plus one partners. And clarifying to these partners that the alternative to pressure through sanctions could be pressure through Israeli military force. And therefore, these partners should agree to stepped up sanctions. Clarifying that Israel opposes granting legitimacy to Iran's enrichment program. And finally, continued covert action under the radar to delay Iran's nuclear advances. But the revelation in November 2013 of the secret negotiations that the United States had conducted with Iran in Oman over the course of 2013, and by the way, this was behind the backs not only of Israel, but of all the other P5 plus one partners. The United States did not share this with anyone. This clarified that something had changed in President Obama's approach and that Netanyahu was out of the loop. And there was a sense of betrayal for Netanyahu. And everything that Obama had previously promised, for example, there was an important moment in March of 2012 at the AIPAC gathering, yearly gathering, the policy conference, when Obama spoke and he promised emphatically that the U.S. policy on Iran was prevention and not containment. Containment means not necessarily preventing the outcome of a nuclear Iran, but making sure to contain Iran, to be able to deter Iran if it were to go nuclear. Obama said, no, please don't think that's my policy. I have a policy of prevention. But with the revelation of the secret negotiations, this was also suddenly with a question mark. Was Obama's policy really prevention? This was starting to become a more prominent question. Would he hold out for a good deal? What had been promised to Iran in Oman? And I can tell you that only in July 2014 was it reported that the United States had conveyed to Iran in these secret negotiations that it was willing to accept a limited uranium enrichment program as part of a final deal. That was already promised in March of 2013. That's before the negotiations began, before Rouhani became president, et cetera. And there were questions. What were the administration's true goals? Were they pressed to dismantle Iran's nuclear infrastructure, or would they allow Iran indeed to maintain a more significant enrichment program? And once negotiations on a final deal began in January 2014, Netanyahu was experiencing an acute sense of frustration. And it was not hard to understand his frustration. It emanated from the very simple setup that, on the one hand, Israel was outside the formal negotiations, had no direct influence on or control over whatever was being agreed to with Iran. And on the other hand, it was Israel that would suffer the most from the failure of those that were at the table and that were making whatever concessions that were being made to Iran in order to secure a deal. So Netanyahu was desperately trying to get Israel's voice heard. But the ongoing Netanyahu-Obama tensions and clash of personalities prevented Netanyahu from making headway. And his frustration grew, and things came to near boiling point. And the more Netanyahu tried to force Obama to take his concerns into account, the more Obama backed away and shut Netanyahu out. And the tension and animosity culminated, of course, in March 2015 with Netanyahu's speech to Congress. Now, a question that we might never be able to answer is whether Israel actually meant to attack Iran's nuclear facilities at some point during the years 2009 to 2013, or whether it was all about creating deterrence, namely pressure on the international negotiators, not on Iran, on the international negotiators, so that they would not settle for less than a good deal. It's not even clear whether Israel seriously deliberated this question, whether the military option that they were working on, and that's a fact, whether it was for actual use or for deterrence, and that's an important question. There's evidence that the threat had an effect on the Europeans. I've heard this from European diplomats, that it convinced them to go for the biting sanctions in 2012 that were an important lever of pressure when negotiations began in earnest in 2013. People that are in the know say that only two people know the answer to the question whether Israel actually intended to use military force: Netanyahu himself and his defense minister, Ehud Barak. Then they continue on and say maybe only one person knew, Netanyahu. And then they continue on and say, and maybe even Netanyahu didn't know whether Netanyahu actually meant to use military force. What we do know is that in late 2011, early 2012, things came to a head over the military option when some senior ex-officials, most notably former head of Mossad, Meir Dagan, began sounding a warning bell that taking military action, and these are Dagan's words, more or less, would be a supremely stupid act. So these officials obviously did believe that Israel was on the verge of taking a decision to attack Iran's facilities, but I think it behooves us all to recall that in the two instances where Israel did take military action, that's Iraq in 1981, Syria in 2007, you will notice that there was absolutely no talk about it beforehand. And I think that suggests that it might have been more about deterrence than actual preparations for attack. Another question that we may never know the answer to is whether there was any deal that Netanyahu would have been satisfied with. Was he putting forward what many viewed as unrealistic demands regarding zero enrichment that he knew would not be accepted because he didn't want to negotiate a deal? Or were these conditions that he simply believed could not be accepted? So I can tell you that some people, and I've asked a lot of people this question, people that should know, some people believe that there was no deal that would have satisfied Netanyahu. Others insist that he believed that conceding on uranium enrichment could only lead to a bad deal, and that's why he was insisting on it. What I can tell you is that there's no doubt that one of the more serious flaws of the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, otherwise known as the Iran nuclear deal, goes to the fact that the deal not only leaves Iran with an enrichment program, not only leaves Iran enriching uranium and with plans in year 11 to install thousands of advanced centrifuges, this is a very serious matter, but basically legitimizes Iran's uranium enrichment program. And these were very serious concessions that were made by the P5 plus one, and they weaken the JCPOA considerably. They're not the only problem, but they're a big one. Final issue is how, and with this I will conclude, regards how the JCPOA is actually viewed in Israel beyond Netanyahu, and how certain messages that were voiced by Israeli security establishment figures were distorted and misrepresented by the Obama administration for political purposes within the U.S. internal debate. This is something that I've written at least two articles on. The Obama administration was trying to drive a wedge between Netanyahu and defense and security establishment figures in Israel regarding the Iran deal. So certain statements of Israeli security figures saying the deal was maybe not bad were showcased to prove that it was only Netanyahu that saw problems with the deal. In other words, not only was Netanyahu marginalized and isolated in the wider international debate, but even in Israel, everyone was against Obama. This is the picture that the Obama administration, everyone was against Netanyahu, sorry. This is the picture that Obama, the administration, was trying to create. But there was a lot of distortion and misrepresentation here, and I'll give you some examples. Some of the statements that were issued by these security establishment figures were intended for domestic audiences, and their emphases were for domestic audiences, not to be taken into the U.S. debate. So if statements emphasize that U.S.-Israel strategic relations are very, very important, and Netanyahu might be jeopardizing them by confronting the U.S. president in the manner that he was confronting them, that doesn't mean that those people thought that the Iran nuclear deal was a good one. What they were saying was to Israelis, understand, your prime minister is doing something problematic because he's talking about the Iran deal in a way that's challenging U.S.-Israeli strategic relations. And in the bigger picture, that's more important. We need to have those relations good to deal with every challenge that we have. Some people were saying, trying to calm down the Israeli public and saying, okay, the deal's not good, but Israel's strong. This doesn't mean that Israel is facing annihilation. But what happened is that these statements were taken sort of with a cut and paste, and the part that was not very critical of the Iran deal without the other parts was incorporated directly into the U.S. debate. And you can find different organizations, you know, just giving lists of these quotes to show how Israel's security establishment actually supported the Iran deal. Now, some of the ex-security officials in Israel that pronounced judgment on the deal, I'm sorry to say, did not have the necessary expertise to pronounce judgment. Now, this is something that goes on in Israeli society. It might go on in other places. But people that are security officials, suddenly people think that if they talk about any issue that has some relevance to security, they are an authoritative voice. And it's simply not the case. If you don't know about nuclear issues, if you don't know about the history of U.S.-Iranian negotiations, P5+1 Iranian negotiations, you can't pronounce judgment on this deal. You will read the JCPOA and you won't notice all the pitfalls because you have to understand nuclear issues and the negotiating dynamic to understand where the pitfalls are. So if an Israeli security official says, well, the deal looks okay, we delayed them for 10 years. If we had used military force, we only would have delayed them 3 to 4 years. That's not an authoritative voice pronouncing the Iran deal a good one. Okay? But these voices as well were directly incorporated into the U.S. debate as if these Israelis were supporting the deal. And things came to a really extreme case with the words of Israel's chief of staff, Gadi Eisenkot, who just a year ago at INSS annual conference spoke about the Iran nuclear deal. And he said there are two timelines. There's a 5-year timeline and there's a 15-year timeline. 5-year timeline, there are some opportunities because the immediacy of the threat has been pushed back. However, in the 15-year timeline, we could very well be up against a big problem. Why? Because nothing has changed in terms of Iran's basic interests. Iran still has hegemonic aspirations for the Middle East. And by the way, he continued to talk about all the dangerous things that Iran is currently doing in the Middle East. What made its way into the U.S. debate? You know, highest Israeli defense official sees opportunities with the historic Iran deal. Okay, so that's what made it into the debate, to the point where in the vice presidential debate, Tim Kaine said that the Israeli chief of staff supports the Iran deal, that he thinks is a good deal that stops Iran from getting nuclear weapons. The distortion reached, you know, those heights, and that's simply not true. At the end of the day, Israel's concerns about Iran in the nuclear realm were always high, but its options for doing something about it were always limited. It tried to work with international actors while pursuing its own independent options as well, whether covert action or preparing a military strike option. But fundamentally, this is an international security issue that stems from Iran's violation of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Moreover, a key to Israel's ability to have more of an influence is, of course, the United States. And when relations with Obama went sour, it was pretty much game over as far as Israel's ability to have its concerns represented. Of course, it's important to remember that Netanyahu's concerns are shared by many experts, both in Israel and in the wider international community, certainly in the United States. I think there are some in Europe as well. This was never an Israel agenda, although it was often perceived that way, and I have to say, not in the least, because Netanyahu did make one major mistake, which was making this issue all about Israel. Thank you.